Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
We're in Parshat Tazria. This morning we are in the Parsha about skin disease that can also be found on houses and on garments. So is clearly not leprosy, because leprosy isn't found on walls and clothing and cloth, right? So we're clearly dealing with something else. So we are dealing with a condition that rendered one really, 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 really tame. That's really the issue. The issue is not so much the disease itself. It's more about the state of impurity that it communicates to a person. So that's why the Torah is so concerned with tzara'at, with this disease, because it renders someone seriously impure, so much so that they have to be isolated so that the impurity doesn't spread. And the same with houses and clothing, like, you know, you have to deal with it radically because the amount of tum'ah, the amount of ritual impurity that it communicates is so high that it's dangerous to the entire community. So that's the huge reaction to tzara'at is it's really a reaction to a certain radioactive level of tum'ah. It's not so much the disease itself. It's not terminal, because the person gets better and then is purified. So it's not that if someone gets it, they are horrified the way we are when someone says it's stage 4 cancer. It's not that, because that our horror is about disease is really about longevity, right? It's about survival. It's about how painful will this be and is it life threatening? That is not the case with tzara'at. It is not reputed to be painful, and it is not fatal. So the incredible level of detail and of quarantine and of ritual and of everything that goes along with this is really about the level of tum'ah that it communicates. We don't get any discussion of what they thought about what causes tzara'at. Some people want to argue that because at the end of the ritual, which we're going to look at next week, the person brings a sin offering. Some people want to suggest, so they must believe that sin is somehow responsible for this condition. For sure, that's where the rabbis want to go. The rabbis want to go to, there has to be a reason someone gets tzara'at and someone else doesn't. And for them, they don't diagnose tzara'at in their world, the rabbis. It's not something that we can diagnose, only the high priest could. But the idea that it was so bad drives the rabbis to want to figure out, you know, so what's the cause? And for them, they go to an explanation, that it is brought about by, lashon hara, by evil speech, by gossip, by talking about other people. So the mitzorah, is the person suffering with tzara'at, the mitzorah. And the rabbis want to say, don't read mitzorah, change the vowels, and you get motzi ra, motzi, who brings forth evil. Motzi shem ra, who brings forth the evil name, meaning people who, somebody who talks about other people in a way that brings forth a bad name for them. It's a leap, to put it mildly. It's a leap. But it's funny that it really has become normative in Jewish circles when talking about tzara'at, this disease. It's normative to talk about gossip. I think part of it is that people don't want to talk about tzara'at, right? It just doesn't speak to us very much, but talking about people talks to us, right? That speaks to us because we do it all the time. So, you know, I've taught several years on this parsha from Jonathan Sacks and all these other people who really talk a lot about language and about words and about how our words create reality and destroy reality and create reputations and destroy reputations and the seriousness of it. And it's not that I don't still believe that. It's just that it really is a huge leap. So it's fine if we want to talk about the dangers of speech. I think that's, and responsible speech. I think that's fine. It's just not the first thing that comes to mind anymore for me around Sara'at. For a lot of rabbis, it's a way to have something to talk about, right? Just talk about what the rabbis talked about, right? Because that's better to talk about than this. But I want to stay with this. I want to stay with the biblical text. I want to stay with the biblical context because I think it also has some really important things to communicate. Number one, Sara'at cannot be diagnosed by anyone but the high priest. So this means it doesn't matter if you have it. You are not Tameh until the high priest declares that it is Sara'at. So what's interesting, yeah, it's very interesting, that it's not the Sara'at that makes you Tameh. It's the diagnosis of Sara'at that makes you Tameh. You're just as, if I have a lesion, I am just as Tameh right now as before Bob comes in the room and tells me I have Sara'at, right? Like, that's how we would think about it. Like, medically, I'm just as infectious, as infected, right, as whatever, as I am when they give me the lab results. Not so in the case of Sara'at. The person is not Tameh until the high priest diagnoses it as Sara'at. So that's number one. It's the priest's declaration that renders someone impure. The other thing is that it's the high priest himself who has to go look at the person and examine the person. And this has to happen like up to three times.
Really?
Yes. And so if it's not clear, the high priest comes back in a week. So this person is completely isolated outside the camp. And yet the high priest, the most important ritual functionary in the cultic system, is the one to go check on this person, to go see what's happening. And the word see, look, see, is used like a lot in this parsha. And so it's used so much that like lots of people comment on it. So I think one of the messages we get is however strongly Israelites reacted to Sara'at and whatever it was and the impurity it can communicate, it didn't render the person less worthy of the care and attention of the most important person in the cult. I find that important, that the most important person is going to go look and see and look and see and look and see and look at the person, right? And the rabbis lift up, look at the person means see the person, not the disease.
Would that be a projection of the imperfection of the cult to the priest?
So say more.
So that one of his constituents, or many of his constituents, have this, he puts himself at risk to go there because it's contagious. But is he going there for the care? But is he also going there as a concern that this is a reflection on him?
Interesting. So surely, if you attribute a cause to Sara'at, then they have reason to be nervous that something's going on that's causing it. So possibly, yeah, what's going on in my flock that somebody's come down with something that indicates something's off? I think, though, it's more about, and I have no basis for this other than just having studied Torah for a long time, but I think it's about a concern for the possibilities for the cult if that kind of tum'ah is present and is not addressed. Then the cult has some very serious stuff to worry about, right? So possibly there is a kind of like, huh, I wonder what's up, you know, that's going on, that my people are coming down with this. But the other is, if someone has it, it's so communicable. The tum'ah is so communicable that you worry for the cult. Because why are we worried about tum'ah and the sanctuary? Why are we worried about it so much? Why do we care about it?
Keeps God away.
It keeps God away. So that's the real fear, is if this thing gets out of control, right? We're right. God can't be here. And if God can't be here, we're toast, essentially.
I have a real problem with this.
Bert has a real problem.
Well, I've got two problems. One is, and this is part, there's other things about anything that physically is not, quote, normal, somehow is bad, which is not good for handicapped people. And then the second thing is that it's only a hereditary priest who can say yes. So on the one hand, the person is the dependent on the hereditary priest. And on the other hand, there's this idea that people with whatever can be considered physical disability that is determined by this unelected person will pollute the community.
All right, so a couple things.
I hope we can reconstruct.
We're going to work hard on reconstructing it. So a couple things. One, it's not any condition. It's not any handicap. It is it is a very, very specific disease.
Well, aren't other ones mentioned?
No.
Lame people or?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Chickenpox or mumps or measles?
Neither.
Okay.
It's neither.
Psoriasis.
You'll see. Mm-hmm. It might be psoriasis. Well, it's very specific. Mm-hmm. And so it's not any disability. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that in the ancient world, they didn't look at people with disabilities as somehow being a little cursed. They did. But that's not this. This is Tazria, mm-hmm. right? This is the disease Tzara'at. It is a very specific condition. And it's not that the person's bad, and it's not that Tzara'at is bad. Mm-hmm. It's Tum'ah that's bad. So how do I make that distinction? The impurity that Tzara'at can spread is a God chaser. Mm-hmm. That's what's bad. Not the person and not the disease. The tum'ah, the impurity, is what is dangerous for the community because it repels God. Does that make sense? And that's dangerous. Without God around, we're vulnerable to all kinds of things. That's why it's bad.
Because it also applies to buildings.
Say again?
Yeah.
Because it also applies to buildings.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So we're going to look at how specific it is. The other thing that Zornberg lifts up that I studied with y'all last year that I had never thought about this is that, to your point about an unelected person is the one to make it so, this person is God's elected. God elected this person. Right? God has a veto, right? So God elected this person, and Tzara'at, according to Zornberg, if we look closely at the language, Tzara'at is actually a miracle. It doesn't happen outside the land of Israel. So Zornberg, you can listen to the podcast from last year, that she understands, and the Torah understands it as a miracle. So like it's an early warning system that if you don't have, you could be in a lot of trouble. But thank God we have Tzara'at to let us know that impurity is loose
on the way.
And y'all need to take care. Like, do what has to be done to stop this. You know, those detectors, what are they called? The carbon monoxide detector, right? You know, it's like, because you can't see the smoke, you're not going to smell the smoke, you're not right. It's going to detect something that if it's not detected, you could die.
It's almost like having a public portrait of Dorian Gray, like something that people could see that is a representation of some corruption going on in the soul or in the cult of God.
Yes. And so that is considered a good thing, that it can be seen and diagnosed and taken care of.
Okay. What did they do with the houses?
You have to take all your stuff out and all the people out. And then the same thing about, you have to check, is it spreading? Is it not? Right? If it gets to a certain point where it's declared that it's spreading and it is Tzara'at, then they destroy the house.
But it is an interesting idea that somehow if a house or home becomes polluted, in this case, by something physical, but one could also say metaphorically, other things happening in the house, that God can't be there.
Right.
Won't be there.
Right. Right.
It has to do with family purity and I lowercase.
And if we want to reconstruct it, then how we treat each other.
Well, right. That's
a, right. That there isn't godliness in a home where people are abusive to each other.
One little quick question. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that, an attempt to trace back the cause of the affliction? In other words, it's just noticed and they get to the.
Yes.
But not like what was the specific sin or problem that caused it?
No.
Oh, okay.
Nope.
No one remodeled.
Well, hopefully they did.
Oh, okay.
If you knock down the house, hopefully you don't build exactly the same house.
Oh, dear.
But remember their homes would have been a lot more uniform because they didn't spend all their time in the house. And houses, anyway. I'm getting off track. Mm-hmm. I listened to my Torah study from last week and I couldn't make head nor tails of most of that shiur. So I'm going to try to stay on topic. You're laughing a little too quickly over there.
That's an easy topic.
Right. All right. So chapter 13 of the book of Leviticus, let's say a bracha before we begin our text. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher kidshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, God, spirit of the universe, and makes us holy with your mitzvot, one of them being engaging with words of Torah. Wow. Chapter 13, verse 1. Vayidaber Adonai Moshe ve'aharon lemor. Now God speaking to Moshe and Aharon, because Aharon's going to be the key player, right, in all of this. When a person has on the skin of the body a swelling, a rash, or a discoloration, and it develops into a scaly affection on the skin of the body, it shall be reported to Aaron the priest or to one of his sons, the priests. The priest shall examine the affection on the skin of the body. So, right, the ra'aha kohen et anega, the kohen looks at, sees, examines with eyes the nega, the hurty thing, the hurt, what do you, wound, you know, that whatever is disrupted on the skin. So we're going to get this over and over and over and over and over. Vera'a hakohe, the Kohen looks, the Kohen sees the blemish on the skin of the flesh. If hair in the affected patch has turned white and the affection appears to be deeper than the skin of the body, it is tzara'at. When the priest sees it, right? Again, the priest sees v'ra'ahu. The priest sees it. The rabbis want to read v'ra'ahu. The priest sees him. It could be it or him. There's no indicator, mm-hmm. right? Logically, if he's looking at the blemish, then he sees it, right? But the rabbis say, no, read v'ra'ahu hakohen. The priest sees him, meaning the priest sees person and sees the whole person. Vatime oto and time. So it's a verb, the verbal form of impure. So the kohen now, what, how would you say that in English? The verb for impure.
Sorry.
Impurifies, but that kind of implies you're doing it.
It does.
But it is the verb for impure, right? So the priest, yeah. So you have to add a word in English, declares, mm-hmm. pronounces, mm-hmm. but really he makes the person
diagnosis.
Tame.
Mm-hmm.
It's still adding a word. He impurifies the person, right? But that suggests he's doing something that caused it. But do you see what in the Hebrew, it's much clearer that now the person is tame. Once the priest declares it tzara'at, now the person is coming, is impure. But if it is a white discoloration on the skin of the body, which does not appear to be deeper than the skin, and the hair in it has not turned white, the priest shall isolate the affected person for 7 days. So if he doesn't declare tzara'at, the person is outside the camp for a week.
Oh, shit.
Verse 5. V'ra'ahu ha-kohen. Again, the priest looks. The priest sees, examines. on Yom HaShvi'i, on the seventh day. And if the infection has remained unchanged in color and the disease has not spread, the priest will isolate the person for another 7 days. So now it's 2 weeks that the person has to be isolated. Verse 6, guess how it starts? V'ra'aha kohen, right? And the priest shall look. The priest shall see. The priest shall examine again, b'yom hashvi'i, on the seventh day. If the infection is not spread on the skin, the priest shall pronounce the person pure. It is a rash. After washing those clothes, that person shall be pure. Okay? So it's, if it's not sara'at, the person has now been isolated. The priest sees that it's not sara'at. The person is pure.
Isn't only the going back at all that does this?
It's unclear. It seems it can be him or his sons. But if the rash should spread on the skin after the person has been seen by the priest and pronounced pure, that person again shall report to the priest. And if the priest sees that the rash has spread, the priest shall pronounce the person impure. It is leprosy. Negat sara'at. So the blemish that is sara'at, it shall be reported to the priest. Verse 10, something new and different. V'ra'aha kohen. And the priest shall look and shall examine, right? And if they find a skin on the skin, a white swelling, which has turned some hair white with a patch of undiscolored flesh in the swelling, it is bad. It is chronic leprosy on the skin of the body. And the priest shall pronounce the person impure. Being impure, that person need not be isolated. If the eruption spreads out over the skin so that it covers all the skin of the affected person from head to foot, whatever the priest can see, if the priest sees that the eruption has covered the whole body, he shall pronounce as pure the affected person who is pure from having turned all white. Do not ask me. Don't ask me. I know what you're thinking. We don't know. We don't know. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. But it seems that there's a sense, and this is, all we can do is intuit. We have no idea. It's not explained. It's a mystery. It seems that if it's on one part of you, then it's something unusual. If it's all of you, this is your skin, right? Like think of an albino. If it were just one, and I don't mean to pick on, I'm just saying, like, imagine an albino, right? Like, if it's just on one part of you, your skin, you're not an albino. Your skin has, what do we call it? Melanin. Your skin has melanin, right? That one place doesn't. So something's off. If you're all white and have no white in your hair or your skin, nothing's off. That's just you. Does that make sense? The white is not an indicator that something's wrong or off with your skin. It means that's just how you are.
Yeah, but this is somebody who changed. It's one thing if you're born that way, I follow. I need medication. No, but it's a change, and that's significant.
So all I can think is it is actually a decision of compassion. That if the person is now entirely covered by this change, you can't ask them to live outside the camp frame. I mean, it's not going to go away. If it's from head to toe, it's now who they are. Mm-hmm. And to your point, they're rendered pure. It's not bad. It's now who they are. And they're not outside the camp, right?
That's not interesting to sort of Bert's point about earlier about people with disabilities, like, rather than setting the baseline at normal for our society, it's setting the baseline at, like, normal for the individual. And so Za'aronot is about a change in individual rather than a, like, deviation from a societal norm.
Nice.
Which is interesting.
I like that. Right. It's not like you look at it and take a swab and the swab comes back negative or positive, right? It's about, has it spread on that person?
Yeah. And rather than, like, you are weird to us, it's like, I'm having an internal experience that feels weird to me that is the, I don't know, and now I'm spitting up.
And maybe that's why the priest has to go so many times, because, you know, the inclination in a, quote, normal society is like, whoa, what the heck is going on here? I'm out of here. You're.
For sure. And that is a lot of what our, you know, commentators lift up, is that it's the priest is somebody special, right? And you're sending your biggest specialist to look at the person. You know, it's not like, ugh, we don't want to deal with that. Come back when you're better, right? It's no, we're going to take care of this and address it and look at 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 it some more. Okay.
Were there remedies?
We're going to look at the remedy next week. If I do it now with you now, I've got nothing to teach next week. So, and I found some cool stuff for next week.
Something that needs to be remedied.
What has to be remedied, to be clear, it's not treated. Sarat is not treated. What has to be remedied is the state of the person's impurity. Mm. That's what has to be dealt with, not the Sarat. Okay? The Sarat is not addressed or treated. No. It goes away on its own, which is how we know it's not Hansen's disease. It's not leprosy. But people have left the translation of leprosy in because of how the stigma of leprosy was so acute that it's a better term because it carries with it that sense of stigma. All right. If the undiscolored flesh again turns white, the person shall come to the priest and the priest shall conduct an examination. If the affection has turned white, the priest shall pronounce as pure the affected person who is then pure. When an inflammation appears on the skin of one's body and it heals, and a white swelling or a white discoloration streaked with red develops where the inflammation was, the person shall report to the priest. Verse 20, guess how it starts? Vera'ah ha-kohen. And the priest looks, right, to see that it appears lower than the rest of the skin and that the hair in it has turned white. The priest shall pronounce the person impure. It is sarat that has broken out in the inflammation. But if the priest find that there's no white hair in it and it is not lower than the rest of the skin and it is faded, the priest shall isolate that person for 7 days. If it should spread, the priest shall pronounce the person impure, right? It is sarat. Okay. So you can see this goes on and on and on and on, right? Again, seventh day. So you can imagine for the person who is undergoing this, they're sitting there with nothing to do. They can't participate in regular life while they're waiting another 7 days. I don't know if y'all have ever spent any time recovering from anything, but sitting on the couch, and we have television,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I don't know about y'all, but I was ready to jump out the window to get out of there, right? Like I was crazy after a few days. And it's not like I could do anything anyway. Like I was loopy on oxy and what, but it's like, it's crazy making, sitting there with nothing to do. And so what Shefa Gold points to is that might be part of dealing with Sarat. The isolation is not just to protect the rest of the camp, but it's to give the person an opportunity to kind of be with whatever's happening without the distraction of working and doing what we do when we're part of our daily communal life.
They were not put in with the other people who left. You were isolated from everything.
We're not told, but they're outside the camp. So they're outside of daily life. So even if there's a hut, you know, a little over there with somebody else with Sarah, it's not normal life, right? They're not cooking and cleaning and taking care of the kids and, you know, chopping wood, and they're not doing the stuff that you usually do. They're just there. And so that has to be on some level anxiety producing. The priest is coming back tomorrow. Am I getting out of here? I think of, you know, we learned a lot during COVID about, you know, people who traveled and had to be quarantined in a hotel for, at one point, if you'll recall, it was 14 days.
Right.
And you heard reports of people like going, oh my God, you know, like in this hotel room, I'm like climbing the walls. And they have TV and cell phones and TikTok, right? Like, hello, you can watch animal rescue videos all day long. And they're climbing the walls. Mm-hmm. So this person has been there 7 days, and they may be told tomorrow when the priest comes, it's another 7 days I have to be here, right? And so, you know, we read right past it, but it's a thing.
But does the community take care of them? Bring them?
Yes. 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 So, or, you know, they bring the food and leave it. But they are, yes, they are cared for. Right? You wouldn't survive very well 14 days of no food and water. And if you can't cook, but it's suggested that, you know, they are.
Is this like all obsessed with skin stuff? I mean, what is this? I mean, is leprosy even that common? I know it's not leprosy, but I mean, all of this is about skin. Is that the only way they appreciated illness? Or
what
no, 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 no. You are totally missing the point, Lisa. Meaning because we're, I don't mean Lisa. We miss the point because we're Western. Y'all are not thinking like an ancient Near Eastern Israelite. It's not the illness that's the problem. They know from pneumonia. They know from pleurisy. They know from edema. They know from malaria. They know those diseases. Those are illnesses. This is tzara'at. This is a danger of impurity that can repel the divine.
But it manifests itself, they're saying.
For them, this particular impure of impure impurities erupts through the skin. Right. That's how you know it's going on, is by looking at the skin. But you look at the walls of a house to see it also, or on a piece of, you know, fabric.
What, dare ask what you do with this today?
Funny you should ask.
So is it rather than sort of like leaving aside the possibility of what happened with monotheism in Egypt, rather than this, you know, us being the first truly monotheistic religion, are we the reframe it as we're the first ones to really be so obsessed about purity?
I am not versed enough in Mesopotamian religion to know that, to know how much there is or is not a system that deals with ritual impurity. I don't know. Bless you. So I can't answer that. What I can say is that early Israel was very concerned with both, and this is where, you know, the prophets start yelling and screaming. It's like, you know, y'all are so worried about Sarat, and you're so worried about this, and you're so worried about that, but you don't care that you're stealing from the business down the street, and you think the divine presence is going to rest on the community. What the heck is wrong with you? Right. So, so there seems to be a hyper focus, right, on Tum'ah and Tahara, on impurity and purity, that seems to go to a core that I have to believe did not get invented with the Israelites. You know what I mean? I can't imagine it comes out of nowhere. I have to believe in the ancient Near East, there is an understanding of the forces of purity and impurity, holiness and ickiness, that, because lots of people sacrificed, lots of people did that stuff. There's like, you know what I mean? I have to imagine it comes from the neighborhood, and we just got super obsessive about it.
But also, to me, it feels like it makes sense. I mean, just like last week or a couple of weeks ago, we had this force just like come, like zapping people. Like people, the stakes of interacting with God wrong are so high.
Yes.
And I feel like it, whether it is healthy or not, like the instinct to, we are going to tread very carefully around this force, seems reasonable given those stakes.
Right. I think that's fair. To assess it on its own terms, I think that is exactly right. It goes to such extreme detail because you are dealing with the possibility of nuclear radiation spreading. right? Because if God is the nuclear force, right, that can be incredibly destructive and very helpful, right. Then you need to mitigate at all costs and in every way where there is anything that can, right, keep that from being good for you, for the people. So a couple of things to Lisa's question. One of the things we do with it is take seriously the rabbinic interpretation that is a purposeful misreading to say the high priest sees him, that we are very quick to turn away from things that disgust us. And often the things that disgust us are things that are wrong with another person. And that is a normal human response to something scary. And let's be honest, when we are disgusted by somebody else's bodily whatever, it's because we're scared that we're going to get it, that it could happen to us, right? That's really what's going on. And so the rabbis are very clear to purposefully misread that verse and say, the priest sees him. The priest looks at him, the person, and sees a person, and then deals with whatever's happening for that person and does not turn away. And that is our obligation when someone's hurting or when somebody's body is going through something. Our job is to tend to it. And the most important people in the camp are the ones who do that, right? And that when people are isolated, that we should be checking on them, right? We should call George and see how he is, right? Just because he's not here doesn't mean he doesn't exist for us. He's home recovering. And it's important that we help people remember that they matter to us, even when they're not here, even when we can't see them. And so I think those are ways that the tradition, anyway, has read into this, things that we're supposed to take very seriously. We're going to go to the end of this binus. Verse 46. Kol yimei asher hanegabo. Yitma tamehu badad yeshev michutz lamachane moshavo. All the days that the eruption, right, is causing impurity, this person who was impure, badad yeshev, alone shall dwell. Badad, alone. Michutz lamachane, outside the camp, moshavo, is his place. So let's look a little bit. Let's look at an anthropological first understanding of this from Mary Douglas, who gives us some really, really amazing work around ancient civilizations and some of the meanings of this stuff for them. This is from Purity and Danger, an analysis of concepts of pollution and taboo, which is exactly what we're dealing with here. Right. So Mary Douglas is approaching all of this as an anthropologist. Mary Douglas is quoting someone called Van Gennep, and a sociological insight into this. He saw society as a house with rooms and corridors in which passage from one to another is dangerous. Danger lies in transitional states simply because transition is neither one state nor the next. It is undefinable. Therefore, it is dangerous. The person who must pass from one to another is himself in danger and emanates danger to others. So, Hannah, I think this goes to your point of translating impurity as danger. It's a very good translation. The danger is controlled by ritual, which we're going to talk about next week, which precisely separates him from his old status, segregates him for a time, and then publicly declares his entry to his new status. And this happens in lots of ways and in lots of cultures all over the world, even to today, right? These liminal phases. You take the kid out of society. You isolate him. You scare the hell out of him. And he's alone. You make him go through a trial. Then you bring him back and he's now declared an adult. Right? These are the rites of transition from childhood to adulthood that we see. And a lot of them include, by the way, circumcision. Circumcise them and then they bring them back to the society, and now they are, and they go through a ritual, and now they are adults. So we see this in lots of different ways. We're applying it, of course, to the leper, to Tzara'at. Not only is transition itself dangerous, but also the rituals of segregation are the most dangerous phase of the rites. So this business of badad, this business of being alone outside the camp, is considered the most dangerous time, which is interesting. It seems that if a person has no place in the social system and is therefore a marginal being, all precaution against danger must come from others. He cannot help his abnormal situation. If you're outside society, there's nothing you can do. You're outside. This is roughly how we ourselves regard marginal people in a secular, not a ritual context. Social workers in our society, concerned with the aftercare of ex-prisoners, report a difficulty of resettling them in steady jobs, a difficulty which comes from the attitude of society at large. A man who has spent any time inside is permanently outside the ordinary social system. With no right of aggregation which can definitively assign to him a new position, he remains in the margins with other people who are similarly credited with unreliability, unteachability, and all the wrong social attitudes, right? So it is the isolation of the person from normative society that is the most dangerous phase. And without a ritual to proclaim them totally done with that, And again, we're going to talk a lot about this. I want you to hold on to this for next week. Without that, there's a stigma that still attaches. So someone has been inside, meaning in the penitentiary, there's a stigma. They are now still outside of normative society. And this went on to quote, I didn't put it here, but went on to quote people who have been institutionalized for mental health. Things that were just quirky behavior when the person's home, if they've been institutionalized for it for any length of time, now the stigma is, whoa, through the roof, and they are treated differently. And there were lots of studies that proved this. Y'all who are in the business would know more than I do about that, but it was really scary to hear that, you know, well, it was just kind of, I don't know, they're eccentric, right? When they're living home, if they're put if they're treated by a mental, you know, health institution of any kind, that the stigma is, it stays.
Which causes a lot of people not to seek help.
That's exactly right. Okay. So lest we think we don't have this issue, right? Like, lest we think so. All right. Those who turn away their faces, Rachel Adler. Societies dread invasion. Lisa, this is to your point. Societies dread invasion, disintegration, and inundation. Those were the big dangers in the ancient world, right? Hence the extremities and borders of our nations and our bodies are loci of concern, right? Places where integrity might be breached and order overthrown. Human skin is a long continuous boundary that demarcates the most basic of borders, the border between the human body and the world outside it. Breaches in the skin, such as those of Tzara'at, are attacks on the body's wholeness. They leave the raw flesh vulnerable to the external world or display flesh taken over by externalities. So in some way, that goes to your issue about, like, why is it skin? Because the skin is our boundary, is our border. And just as a nation, ancient nations would have feared inundation and being taken over and invaded. That is what a skin disruption signals. Your boundary, your border has been breached. It's the first line of defense. And it's what demarcates me from everything that's not me. And so the obsession and focus on what's happening on that border and boundary states the health of our borders, right?
Interesting, because it suggests the depths of our fear of invasion and inundations that we're seeing now with the border issues somewhere else.
I was just going to say that. Look at the fixation on the borders. That, right? very deep and bypasses in some ways. And I'm not trying to minimize the problem. I'm just saying it bypasses logic and goes right to the amygdala.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? It goes right to lizard brain screaming, they're going to take over.
Huh.
Right? Why do you think The Walking Dead was so popular?
Mm-hmm.
We are so afraid of it spreading and them taking over, right? That show plays right into really, really primitive fears that we still have. Was your hand raised, Nick?
Was it?
Well, it was kind of this. It was doing this.
Oh.
So you're going to have to clarify if this is raising a hand.
So.
Okay. All right. Well, if you don't think so, the pollution and poisoning of our blood, right? That's making people a little nutty right now, right? The pollution of our blood by all these people coming in, right? It's like it's for real. No, sorry. The reaction is for real. They're really scared that our blood is being poisoned. It's like, wow, right? We think this stuff is crazy. That's crazy, right? That's I don't understand why we don't. People will read this and go, oh my God, 3,000 years ago, look what idiots they were. And we don't say that when people stand up and say, right?
Yeah.
Our blood is being poisoned. It's like, how come we don't call that out as like craziness? But okay. All right. Now I want to go to something I'm going to take a sharp left turn, but I was so moved by it that like I was actually tearing up when I prepared him. Badad. Ibn Ezra goes to this word badad and looks at this word as we find it in the Book of Lamentations in Echa. That we read on Tisha B'Av. Alas, Echa, right? Yashva Vadad Ha'ir. The city sits lonely, once great with people. What's that city? Jerusalem. She that was great among nations is become like a widow. The princess among states is become a thrall. Bitterly she weeps in the night. Her cheek wet with tears. There is none to comfort her of all her friends. All her allies have betrayed her. They have become her foes. So now Badad is about Yerushalayim that was so amazing and now is destroyed. Rashi on that verse in Lamentations translates Vadad alone as Galmud. Of her inhabitants, devoid of her inhabitants. And Aviva Zornberg talks about Galmud. There are two moments in the description of isolation that particularly resonate in their poignancy. And she's bringing this about Tzara'at, right? So I didn't make this up. This is Aviva Zornberg's beautiful left turn. There are moments in the description of isolation. So the leper who is isolated, right? That the badad condition and the crying out of tameh, like impure, impure. This badad condition, the state of badad strikes the keynote of the Book of Lamentations, how she sits lonely, the many-peopled city. Galmud has dense, so she's quoting Rashi, Galmud has dense associations, menstruous, lonely, weaned, separated from her husband, like a shapeless, lifeless lump. Mm-hmm. How she sits lonely, Rabbi Alexander said, I am wakeful. I am like a lone bird upon a roof. Rabbi Alexander is saying this is God talking in Psalms, not the psalmist. Another left turn. I am alone, God is saying. God said, I am wakeful to rest my presence in the holy temple forever. I am like a lone bird. Just as this bird, when her goslings are taken from her, sits lonely, so I have burned my house. Destroyed my city and exiled my children among the idolaters. So I sit lonely, as it is written from Echa, how she sits lonely. God becomes the subject of the Badad description of the stripped city. Like a lonely bird deprived of her goslings, God stays close to the holy temple, bewailing the loss of the temple, his temple, her city. Her children, The pathos of the simile is complicated when God reveals that he's the destroyer of his own place in the world. In a surrealistic move, the mourning bird becomes the source of his own undoing. Both victim and aggressor, she gathers into herself all the resonances of lamentation. But whose fault is it? Whose fault is it that God had to do that?
Ours.
Ours. It's our fault that God is alone, that God had to destroy God's own house. God had to destroy God's city, and God had to have the Israelites dwell among idolaters. Whose fault is that? Ours. Because we screwed it all up.
Now he's constrained from starting over.
And God can't start over because we haven't fixed it. God is sitting alone like a leper because of us. The word badad, with its fraught later meanings in Psalms and Lamentations, sheds those meanings back onto its early appearance in the laws of the leper, its earliest appearance. The first use of badad enfolds within itself implications that will later unfold, says Zornberg. Which reminded me, this image of what we've done, causing God to have to destroy God's apartment with us. God wants to live with us, but had to destroy our first apartment together as a couple because we screwed it all up. And it reminded me of Rabbi Maggie Wenig's piece, God is a Woman and She's Growing Older. And so we'll close with this piece. God is a woman and she's growing older. She moves more slowly now. She cannot stand erect. Her face is lined. Her voice is scratchy. Sometimes she has to strain to hear. God is a woman and she is growing older, yet she remembers everything. On Rosh Hashanah, the anniversary of the day on which she gave us birth, God sits down at her kitchen table, opens the book of memories, and begins turning the pages. And God remembers. There is the world when it was new, and my children when they were young. As she turns each page, she smiles, seeing before her, like so many dolls in a department store window, all the beautiful colors of our skin, all the varied shapes and sizes of our bodies. She marvels at our accomplishments, the music we've written, the gardens we've planted, the stories we've told, the ideas we have spun. They now can fly faster than the winds I send, she says to herself. And they sail across the waters, which I gathered into seas. They even visit the moon, which I set in the sky, but they rarely visit me. There, pasted into the pages of her book, are all the cards we have ever sent to her when we did not bother to visit. She notices our signatures scrawled beneath the printed words someone else has composed. Then there are the pages she would rather skip, things she wishes she could forget. But they stare her in the face and she cannot help but remember. Her children spoiling the home she created for us. Brothers putting each other in chains. She remembers seeing us racing down dangerous roads, herself unable to stop us. She remembers the dreams she had for us, dreams we never fulfilled. And she remembers the names, so many names, inscribed in the book. Names of all the children she's lost through war and famine, earthquake and accident, disease and suicide. And God remembers the many times she sat by a bedside weeping that she could not halt the process she herself set into motion. On Yom Kippur, God lights candles, one for each of her children. Millions of candles lighting up the night, making it bright as day. God stays awake all night, turning the pages of her book. God is lonely, longing for her children, her playful ones. All that dwells on earth does perish, but God endures. So she suffers the sadness of losing all that she holds dear. God is home, turning the pages of her book. Come home, she wants to say to us. Come home. But she won't call, for she's afraid that we will say, no. She can anticipate the conversation. We are so busy. We'd love to see you, but we just can't come. Too much to do. Even if we don't realize it, God knows that our business is just an excuse, She knows that we avoid returning to her because we don't want to look into her age-worn face. It is hard for us to face a God who disappointed our childhood expectations. She did not give us everything we wanted. She did not make us triumphant in battle, successful in business, and invincible to pain. We avoid going home to protect ourselves from our disappointment and to protect her. We don't want her to see the disappointment in our eyes. Yet God knows that it is there, and she would have us come home anyway. What if we did? What if we did go home and visit God? What might it be like? God would usher us into her kitchen, seat us at her table, and pour two cups of tea. She has been alone so long that there's so much she wants to say, but we barely allow her to get a word in edgewise, for we're afraid of what she might say, and we're afraid of silence. So we fill an hour with our chatter, words, words, so many words, until finally she touches her finger to her lips and says, "Shh, Shah, be still." Then she pushes back her chair and says, "Let me have a good look at you." And she looks. And in a single glance, God sees us both newly born and dying, coughing and crying and laughing and dancing as a young child, afraid of the road ahead, and as an old person looking back, wondering where the years went. In a single glance, she sees our birth and our death and all the years in between. She sees us. She sees us. She sees us. We were when we were young, when we idolized her and trustingly followed her everywhere, when our scrapes and bruises healed quickly, when we were filled with wonder at all things new. She sees us when we were young, when we thought that there was nothing we could not do. She sees our middle years, too, when our energy was unlimited, when we kept house, cooked and cleaned, cared for children, worked and volunteered, when everyone needed us and we had no time for sleep. And God sees us in our later years, when we no longer felt so needed, when chaos disrupted the bodily rhythms we had learned to rely upon. She sees us sleeping alone in a room which once slept, too. God sees things about us we've forgotten and things we do not yet know, for naught is hidden from God's sight. When she's finished looking at us, God might say, "So, tell me, how are you?" Now we're afraid to open our mouths and tell her everything she already knows, whom we love, where we hurt, what we have broken or lost, what we wanted to be when we grew up. So we change the subject. "Remember the time when..." "Yes, I remember," she says. Suddenly we're both talking at the same time, saying all the things the greeting cards never said. "I'm sorry that I..." "It's all right. I forgive you. I didn't mean to..." "I know that. I do." We look away. "I never felt I could live up to your expectations." "I always believed you could do anything," she answers. "What about your future?" she asks us. We do not want to face our future. God hears our reluctance, and she understands. We are growing older as God is growing older. How much like her we have become.
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.